Welcome to the Lingo Moves Podcast. I am your host and game lawyer, Zachary Strubeck. Today, I'm talking with the man behind Tip and Goat, the studio responsible for Super Slam Dunk Touchdown. Welcome, Rick Felice.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So why don't you start by telling me a little bit about your background and how you got into game development?
I kind of always was coding games as a hobby growing up, either on 8 and 16-bit computers or later in college on slightly more modern PCs. I'd got into web development as a career for like 12 years and eventually made my way into the game industry before deciding to quit and try to do the indie thing.
Very cool. So wait, you had never published a game before you went out?
I'd sold a game to a European publisher for about $700, and then they had me do a Mac port for about $700. I don't know that ever even sold or what happened to it. And I had a few that were on the Xbox Live Indie Games service,
okay,
on the 360, but yeah, nothing full time indie like this.
Okay, were they under the Tipping Goat name as well, or?
No, that was back when I was doing it as a hobby. It was called Planet Idiot Games.
Okay, you've really matured.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
All right, so what pushed you to... You had a full-time job before. You were doing web development, you said? What?
Yeah, and then I got into HTML5 game development.
Okay.
And that's what moved me out to the West Coast. And that project was very quickly canceled after they relocated me, which was kind of funny. And then they had me doing iOS and Android games in Java, which I had never used Java before either, so that was super interesting. But I did that for about a year, and I was like, okay, I'm not being creatively fulfilled here. I need to make this game right now.
Yeah, I guess that's a big question. So, at the job, creative fulfillment, I guess that's the important thing, or you've always wanted to work on your own titles, I guess?
Well, I've always wanted to work on games, and it was really frustrating working on games that I didn't find any fun at all and really disagreed with the free-to-play model they were using and everything. Yeah. It was a cool company. It was great to work for. They used to do hackathons where we could make our own games, but like I would pour all this creative energy into these hackathon games, and then they'd be like, okay, that's nice. Go back to work. And
go back to the soul-sucking.
And this particular game had been burning a hole in the back of my brain for about 6 years at that point.
Let's talk about it. So Super Slam Dunk Touchdown, it's kind of a mashup of different sports, right?
It's essentially a 3D physics game dressed up as a 2D sports game from like the 80s and 90s. The idea is to get a ball into a goal zone. And the balls are all different balls from all different sports, and the players you're using to get the balls where you want them to go are from all different sports. So they all throw or kick the ball or hit it with their bat or their hockey stick or however they shoot is unique to their sport. And then we kind of have these Frankensteinian goals that are like a soccer net with a hoop on it and a field goal for American football on there. And however you get the ball in, you can score depending on which type of goal you use. You get different amounts of points. So that's kind of the basis of the game.
So you must be like a huge sports fan.
I actually like sports games more than I like watching sports.
Yeah, you're more like me. Like I like the closest thing in my mind is the NES ice hockey game, right?
Yep.
Which I'm sure is the game for people who don't really like sports but love sports games, right?
That was kind of the starting point for this when I was trying to figure out how you would make a sports mashup game. I was looking at NES ice hockey and the way that they had the different player types, right? Sure. They had the huge guy and then the tall skinny guy, and like he was fast but he would go down easily, and then you had the big tough guy, and then you had the medium dude who I think kind of looked like Mario. I'm not sure if that was intentional.
The what do you call the referee or whatever was exactly like Mario, wasn't it? I'm trying to remember, it's been a long time.
Yeah, they didn't have a lot of pixel fidelity. Yes. It's open to interpretation. But yeah, so we started out with I had soccer, hockey, and football as my light, medium, heavy players. Mm-hmm. So I worked on balancing those three types of gameplay and then kind of tweaked it from there. And there were a few tweaks to the scoring and the way that the players moved and everything like that had to get adjusted as I added more, because adding basketball really changed the game. Because you can shoot right over the goalie's head. So we had to make the hoop and the field goal worth less points than the lower net.
So I played the game at PAX South, finally.
Yes.
And just, what was that, a month and a half ago. And it was super fun. Of course, I'm terrible at it because I'm pretty terrible at every game. But everyone was having a ton of fun. It was awesome. So, you know, congratulations. You achieved your goal of making someone like me who doesn't like sports.
PAX South is a blast. The crowd there this year and last year was just phenomenal. But you're not alone. A lot of people have a little bit of trouble with the learning curve on the game. Uh-huh. So I'm working on a season mode expansion that's going to be a free update to the game right now. Uh-huh. And so I'm hoping to work in some tutorial-like elements as you recruit new players to kind of ease that a little bit.
Okay. I didn't mean to say that it was like difficult, but just that I'm awful at games. But,
no, it's common feedback. Okay. You know, there's a little bit of a learning curve, and there is no built-in tutorial, so I think that's a gap that I need to fill.
Okay. So the feedback was great from PAX South. Have you gone to any other shows with it?
Yeah, 2015 was kind of my expo year. I'm not sure I should have gone to as many as I did, but I started out with PAX South 2015. That was my first expo, and it was so huge. It really kind of misled me as to how much success I would have at other expos.
Right.
So I started a Kickstarter, and then I went to South by Southwest and GDC, and they were absolutely not the same at all. Very low traffic, very few people. It's hard to get six people at once, for sure, at either of the shifts. And then I did some smaller shows too. So I did like Portland Retro Gaming Expo, and I did SGC, and I did GameRex.
Were the smaller shows maybe better for you? I mean, it seems like if they're directed at you know, retro games or something like that, you would have more success.
Not really. They were fun. They were cheap. I loved going to Portland. I had a great time at SGC and at GameRex, but the traffic, it's just not enough people to get six or even four a lot of the times in front of the game.
Okay.
Which it really shines.
Yeah, PAX South, it seems like there's a ton of people, but there's also more of a focus on indie games, right? Because a lot of the huge games are just not there, the huge companies. So I saw plenty of indie developers who had good crowds like you, right?
Yeah.
And they seemed to be enjoying the feedback they were getting there.
Well, that's what made it such a great show is, you know, you go to an expo, and if you see all the stuff you already know about and you don't want to wait in a four-hour line to play the next AAA game, it can be a little bit of a boring experience, you know, if you don't get to play anything. So with all these little indie booths, you know, you never know what you're going to see. You never know what you're going to play.
Yep.
And it's a lot of fun. And the crowd's just great. The people at PAX South just having a great time.
Yep. Yeah, it seems like they were really, I don't know, even more so than PAX Prime. Just, they were there to have fun and enjoy smaller games. I don't know. It seemed very cool. All right. So how many people actually worked on this game? So you are the company is you, right?
The company is me, yeah. One man show. I've worked with, I'm afraid to count now, but I'm guessing it's seven or eight different artists have worked on this game, and a musician has helped me out. The musician did the in-game music, and he helped me out with the title music. I did the rest of the music. I've done some of the art where I have to. So I did most of it, but
you sound like a true indie. That's good. I mean,
you got to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. Do you have any sort of background in music or?
I guess going back to when I was developing games as a hobby, I had a Commodore Amiga in high school, which was very, very cool computer at the time. It could do digital sound, and it had four audio channels, and it had hardware scrolling, dual play fields, hardware sprites. It had everything you need to make a video game on all these art programs and music programs. So I kind of had to learn all that stuff. Right. At least at a basic level. And I was in a high school band, as many are.
What did you play?
I played guitar, many do.
Oh, man, you're like a cool guy. I played the trombone. Give me a break, man.
I played the trombone, and I was a little younger.
Okay.
But
I stuck with it.
It's good for you.
I don't still play it, but yeah. So.
I would use the Amiga to write songs for my band, that's where the tracker format came from, because the Commodore Amiga had four digital audio channels. So the tracker format was invented and with four tracks, and each track would represent the different notes that would of digital samples that you could play mm-hmm. at different pitches to create the song. So I sort of taught myself from there, and I had a friend who was, you know, sort of a musical savant genius buddy. So tried to pick up what I could from him. So I can do just enough to be dangerous, I guess.
What do you do the music in now?
Now I'm still using a tracker program. I'm using one called Renoise, which is much more advanced than what I had on the Amiga. Because you can not only do unlimited numbers of tracks, you can add all kinds of effects and stuff on it, and use plugins. And that's what I'm using for the sort of chiptune-y sounding sound effects and music.
Do you think it's important, I guess, if you're going for sort of a 80s, 90s aesthetic to use tools like that stay in that realm?
I mean, I like it personally, so that's what I do. I see a lot of pixel art games where you see sprites at different scales and they're rotating them and stuff like that. And I always notice it. And yeah. I don't know if it bothers me that much, but I always notice it. I'm like, it's not really convincing me that this is my game. So I want it to kind of look like it came from back in time and sound like right. It came from back in time. If I had an unlimited budget, I would put a lot more effort into making sure, you know, sprites have X number of colors and there's, you know, there's only so many on the screen and all that sort of thing.
So it's like exact.
Yeah.
Well, there are some developers I've seen that like will make their game and put it on an NES.
Yes.
Cartridge and everything. Right.
Brian Provinciano, the guy who did Retro City Rampage.
Right.
Actually started out with an NES ROM and then built it into a game for cross platform. I mean, that guy's amazing. Yeah. He released on, I think six platforms on the same day. and then he actually went back and finished the NES ROM. Wow. So now you can actually play Retro City Rampage as if it's on Nintendo hardware. That's really awesome. Really hardcore. Yeah. I've never done any, 8-bit programming like that.
One of these days, maybe for the next game. So, how is everything structured legally, right? You have an LLC, right?
Yep.
For Tipping Goat.
Tipping Goat is an LLC. I've trademarked Tipping Goat, and that is a fictitious name I can use for business. So now I'm Tipping Goat. I have to say LLC all the time. Right. it makes the logo a lot nicer.
It's weird. I understand the reasoning behind it, but doing the fictitious name filing is it's probably good, especially if you're, you know, you don't want to throw that LLC on everything. It looks weird for a game company.
Right? Yes, but you see it a lot with the indies, and I know why. There's so many hoops to jump through to set up a company. There's a lot, especially in California, a lot of expensive red tape to hack through.
Yeah, I find that it's also something that people don't know that they have to do, so they just go out there and use it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Planet Idiot Games was never an LLC. It's just I've got a domain name and I threw stuff up there and pretended that I had a company and never made any money.
And that's fine. I mean, if you're not, I don't know. It's not fine. I would say you always want to have an LLC. But, you know, if you have no money and no desire to really move beyond being a sole proprietorship, that's totally fine, I guess. Not to a lawyer, but to a regular person. It's totally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you're in that phase of, oh, I made this, can someone look at it, please?
Right. Well, and sometimes you want to make something and then, you just want people to look at it, or you just want to bring in a little bit of money to prove the fact that, you know, this could be a viable business. And then you start doing the business stuff, which is
right. But if you want to get on Steam or on any of these game stores or on Xbox, they will not deal with you if you don't have not only a business, but a business bank account that they can put the money into. You can't get paid without that.
Yeah. To get the business bank account, you need A, to have the business, B, to have an employer identification number, and I don't know, sometimes you need to provide documents, and it depends on your bank. It's sometimes a huge pain, but
yes, there was a lot of work done in 2015 that was building the game, unfortunately.
I understand. You mentioned that you used a lot of contractors. Do you have any advice on working with contractors for your art?
I don't have a magic bullet. I've had various issues finding and retaining and getting the work done correctly out of different artists, different degrees of success. there's some guys, there's a guy that I've known for years and years. He's still doing the art for me. He's doing all the backgrounds now for Season Mode, and he's awesome. I've never had any issues with him at all. I've had people that just quit. I've had people that just like, I had somebody want take like $400 up front to work on stuff, go through a few rounds of like design and feedback, and then give me my money back and say, nope, I'm not doing it. And it's like, so you just never know, especially for this game, because it's like, well, we already have an art style, so you have to be able to kind of, you know, match the art style. And then I've had people just return junk.
Is it just people that are in games that maybe sort of don't have any professionalism, or?
Well, I think it's that the really good people are really expensive and really busy. And there's a lot of people that are good, that are indie, that are out there trying to make it. And those are the ones that are really hard to find.
Right.
And hard to retain. And then there's a lot of people that, I guess they're, you know, they're not, I wouldn't say they're at that level of being, you know, super, super pro artists. Just like, I wouldn't say I'm like a super, super pro programmer. Okay. They're kind of indie. They're doing a lot of different things. So maybe they can do some decent art, but you know, getting it to conform to this art style or, you know, solving a particular problem may be very challenging for them. And so they may find, oh, this is a lot more work than I thought it was when I signed on to the contract. I really don't know with some of them. There's a guy in Sweden that he takes forever and I never hear from him for like days and weeks at a time. And then he'll come back with the most amazing stuff. And he did all the slam dunk art.
Okay.
So like that guy is great, but he's in another country. So you talk about like, you know, the legal issues of, you know, what if he sells that to somebody else, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, more it's just a problem on your end. Like if you want to go after anyone in another country, it's going to be a huge pain.
Yeah. Yeah. It probably won't happen. So please don't rip me off.
I'm sure that works.
Yeah.
very good. Yeah. It can be hard to wrangle all your contractors and get someone to stay with the project for the whole time. But
biggest piece of advice is get all the paperwork from a lawyer and get it up front before you even start. And I don't care if you know the guy for years and years, make sure you get a contract before you start doing anything.
Absolutely. If nothing else, it allows you to have this discussion before you start working, you know, about what your expectations are and, you know, that you want to own the art and all that, right? And
Not only that, but if they decide this is too much work, you know, give them an out that's on paper. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, or an option like we're going to renegotiate if X, Y, or Z. Because the first guy that I was working with did the bulk of the art, and we were actually going to split the money the game made. Mm-hmm. And he just quit like right before PAX South, which was really terrible timing. But he had just gotten a job that was like really kicking his butt and just didn't have time to give it the attention it needed.
Yeah.
But I wish we could have renegotiated something, you know, as opposed to just like me having to panic and buy him out for PAX South.
I understand.
So, yeah, it's been very challenging. I'd say, you know, getting the legal stuff done in advance is important, but you never know, because you never know like if the guy you're working with is going to like change his mind or whatever.
Sure.
Get busy. And life happens, you know.
You know, and sometimes the practicality of, even if you have a contract, you know, it doesn't stop people from being people and sort of backing out of it or whatever. And then you're left with the choice of, do you pursue legal issues or do you just sort of let it go? Right. And you have to do kind of a cost benefit analysis and say, you know, it's worth my time. You know, it's not even so much money. It's just your time and the stress that it can put on you for having to pursue someone.
Yeah. And you know, when you're kind of, you're responsible for everything.
Yeah.
You know, anything like that where
I understand.
That goes wrong. Very, very stressful.
Yeah. If you're creating your own game and running your own company and doing all that at the same time, it can be difficult. So let's talk a little bit about trademarks. So when you started out, you sent me an email with this story, but you had a conflict right away, huh?
Which has really bummed me out because 6 years ago I started this project in XNA. I had a prototype anyway I was working on, and the game was called Sports Ball. And I guess that was before that term had been thrown around as much on the internet.
Yeah,
I'm not saying I made up the term, but you see it a lot now. There's like comics. You can Google it and there's a million results.
Right. Just like a dismissive term for any kind of sport. Right.
Right. But I never meant it as dismissive. So I'm kind of glad that the name didn't end up as sports ball, because I think a lot of people would have been like,
your new name is a lot more positive.
I want to be positive. Yeah. So I had actually got worried because I kept hearing sports ball used more and more. And I was like, okay, well, I really not only have to make this game, but I got to trademark this thing like so that nobody else comes out with a game called sports ball. And, you know, I was really, really stressing myself out over it. So I had hired a less apt lawyer, I'll say that. And filed the trademark for sports ball, and everything seemed good because there was no trademark filing at the time for sports ball. And Googling for a video game of sports ball after, you know, trying to search through the Google results, which were very muddied, it looked like I was in the clear. But a few months later, I got contacted by the guys from 2DX, and they were like, it was a tweet, actually. It wasn't even an email. So I got a tweet. I got tweeted at, and they're like, hey, can you send us your email address? It was like, which at the time I didn't have any followers. Nobody really knew who Chipping Goat was or what I was doing. So it was really kind of like, okay, that was worried. So I clicked on their Twitter, and there it said 2DX, creators of Bosses Forever and Sports Ball. So I was like, oh no, not this. And, but you know, we got in touch with each other. It turned out they're really cool guys. They were doing the indie thing just like me. And they were actually about to release on Wii U like in 2 months. So they were, you know, finishing up their game, and they had, you know, done all the, they were about to do all the marketing and everything like that. So everything was like hinging on that name. So, you know, I kind of thought, well, if it was me, if I'm about to release sports ball 2 months on Wii U, and you know, some guy comes out of nowhere and trademarks the name like that, you know, what would that be like? So I don't know. I just felt like the right thing to do is let them launch their game and come up with a new name. And it worked out, because Super Slam Dunk Touchdown, I think, is a much better name. And also, those guys are super cool. They really helped me out early on. I hadn't just been starting out with the indie thing, and they had been doing it for a little bit longer, and they had hit some of the expos, and they had a lot of advice and a lot of, you know, information telling me about different places I could take the game and stuff. So, no suing was needed.
That's good.
You hear a lot about trademark stuff with game titles, and it was nice to get that resolved amicably. But of course, we didn't make the news for not suing each other.
so it didn't really.
Yeah.
Yeah, how those things usually work out is, you know, big company either is already using the game or wants to use the name, and they send scary letter to, you know, smaller company, and then the scary letter is usually enough, right?
Right.
You can't find
them. Yeah, if some huge company sent me a cease and desist to sports ball, I'd just be like, well, that sucks.
Time to pick a new name, right? Yeah, and so, you know, a little practical advice for people. So if you... And it sounds like this is what you did. If you plan on using something, you want to get in the trademark as soon as you can, right? So if you finally decided on your name, A, run the name by a lawyer with experience at trademark who can tell you if the name is even good. So if you call, you know, there are a lot of games, there are game names that are not strong trademarks.
Yeah.
I talk about this all the time, but a strong trademark is going to be something that's more distinctive, right? So either a name that you've made up or something that's not describing the game itself. So, you know, good examples are Xerox, Exxon. Those are like these made up words that are completely unique to those specific products, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or Apple is a great trademark for Apple computers, right? Because you know, people think, wow, that's just a generic word. How is that strong? It's strong because it's like completely unrelated to the things that they make, right?
Right.
It's just apples, right? You know, so if you were running an Apple store and you called it Apple, that's a terrible trademark. But if you're running a computer place, Apple is great. So you want to run it by the lawyer, and then you can file something called an intent to use application, which is basically, it gives you, they will... sort of reserve your name with the trademark office, and they'll check it out and make sure that no one else is using it in those types of goods. And then they will, if they grant it, you then have 6 months to prove that you're actually using the trademark, right, in commerce. So you're selling something, I don't know, either a product or a service. You can show your website, or you can show like a Steam store or something like that, somewhere where you can buy the game. And you can also keep renewing that. So the Last Guardian, the Sony game, they had a trademark. They filed an intent to use application years ago, and they it got granted, and then they've had to continue renewing it over and over again because they've been obviously pushing the game back, and you can't use a trademark until they're selling the game.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's the perfect strategy, right? That's the best way to do it, to reserve your name, right? And then so when someone else comes at you and says, hey, we're going to be using this name, you can show, hey, I've already trademarked it, right? It's taken care of.
Yeah, what I understood was that the business use actually can trump the filing. So I had did the filing first for sports ball.
Yeah.
But if it had gone to court, their argument would have been that they were using it in business first, and they could have demonstrated X, Y, or Z.
They could argue it, but the whole
they could argue
in the intent to use application is that you get around that argument, right? You set your trademark priority date earlier than them. Now they may have been using it already before.
Well, they would have been for sale first. I wasn't even. I think I was still in.
It doesn't matter. As far as what I know, that doesn't matter. But
yeah.
Again, you can make the argument.
Either way, nobody wants to go to court and spend that money if you don't have to. Mm-hmm. Especially to indies that don't have any money.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's good that it worked out. But
I'd say that it's more valuable to have good contacts within the indie community
than to have a particular name. Yeah. Especially when you haven't done any marketing or anything yet, right?
Right.
Under that name. Yeah. All right, so you also had some copyright issues, right? I think involving your music.
Yeah, that one was kind of a bummer. I still don't know the answer to this, but for the hat trick music, I wanted to have a little da 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 da, and then have the crowd go, make a little noise. Yeah. So I was like, well, maybe that's trademark. I was always paranoid about this stuff, so I was
copyrighted.
Googling it.
Yeah.
Copyrighted. Okay. Let's get that right. And so, I Googled it to see if it was in the public domain. Mm-hmm. And I found all this stuff in the news about this guy, Bobby Kent, who claimed to have written the song and copyrighted it in 1978. And the internet was kind of blowing up because everyone who was slightly older than that was like, no, I'm pretty sure I heard that before then, the 50s and stuff. And so it kind of got some attention on the internet. People were linking to episodes of the Flintstones that were using that, which is its own copyright issue, right? Why are those on YouTube? But that's what kind of got people interested. And then someone eventually found that somebody else had it under copyright going back to 1955. Uh-huh. So that guy lost, but I don't know who owns it. If the guy's in 1955 owned it, or they hadn't sued anybody, or if they were going to, or I just didn't want to mess with it at that point. I don't have the resources to sit here and do a bunch of research
for like 2 seconds of music. It doesn't seem like it's worth it. Yeah, there's the song Happy Birthday has recently been in the news because there's been court cases over that.
I'm so happy about that because that was such a lie, such an utter lie.
It's actually amazing because they've been taking licensing fees and stuff forever, and
they've been making tons of money. Every movie is going back since then. Like every time you hear Happy Birthday, it's somebody's getting a check.
Somebody Warner.
Somebody who didn't write the song is getting a check.
Amazing. So, sometimes it's bullying, right? Somebody thinks they have the rights and they have a lot of money. So that's how it goes. Unfortunately, the law doesn't always work out perfectly for everyone. But
yeah, and we all took a blow. The whole country took a blow with the Sonny Bono copyright extension thing that got passed. Because now we have like 20 years or something where nothing's going to enter the public domain.
Yeah.
So all the artists and indie gamer creators out there that are wanting to make content, you'd have so much. You'd have this huge wealth of like old movies, old stories, old songs you could use to help market your game and to help tell a story or bring something to life. And now we don't get anything. In fact, I at this point, I'm betting that in 20 years they're just going to extend it again. We're never going to get anything as long
it's
as
very possible
some huge company owns the rights to a lot of stuff. We're
the public.
You know, the Constitution says, that for a limited time is what it says in the Constitution, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Limited. Yeah. So, less than a million years.
120 years for if corporations make it. And then it's like 70 years plus the life of the author or something. So that's a long time.
After the heat death of the universe, it's Mickey Mouse. Yeah.
That sounds good to me. Yeah. As a lawyer, that sounds great. Right. Yeah. No, I'm, I'm the type of copyright lawyer that is sort of, I'm on the fence about it, right? I understand why companies would want to do it, but it also is a little ridiculous. I don't know.
Should be protection, but it should eventually expire within a reasonable time frame.
Right. Well, the good news is anything, I think, before 1923 is in the public domain. So, have at it, man.
Yeah.
The weird thing is like something like Sherlock Holmes, right? There's a number of Sherlock Holmes books, and there was a case about this recently, where any Sherlock Holmes books before 1923 are in the public domain, but anything that happened to Sherlock Holmes in those books after that is still under copyright. So you can't use, I don't know, I think his brother or like his wife or something like that, it's things that happen in later books, right? But you can use all the stuff from the earlier ones. So it even splits if it's the same thing. I think Tarzan might also be in that issue, right? Where it's sort of split. Although Tarzan, there's a bunch of trademarks for Tarzan. So if you go and create your own Tarzan movie, well, guess what? It's trademark infringement, copyright infringement. But
Jungle King got in trouble back in the 80s for that because they had a very Tarzan-like character. And I think they even sampled his little
the yell or whatever.
Yelling, yeah, at the beginning of the game. So there's two arcades. There's Jungle Hunt, which is the redo, which has him as sort of a safari looking dude, and he doesn't yell. And then there's the Jungle King, which has him as sort of this dude wearing a leopard skin. And
I mean that the specific depiction of Tarzan may be copyrighted later, right? Than the original story. So if you go by the original books, but there may be like artwork and character designs after that could be copyright protection. So it's kind of confusing when you get into stuff like that and you want to use someone else's things. I think the best thing to do is to contact someone who knows what they're talking about and can look into this for you, before you get into huge trouble later.
Yep. And the safest thing is, I just wrote my own fanfare sounding music,
that's great.
Just play trumpets at the notes at the, certain notes and come up with something that sounds good. Yep. I guess I like it better if it's original and creative, but for a lot of people, who wants to sit there researching all this and who wants to sit there trying to track all this stuff down? It'd be nice if there was a clear answer. This is in the public domain. This is not.
Absolutely.
Again,
before 1923, there's a there's a website where they what is it? I'll link to it in the show notes. I'm having issues accessing my own website. It's really weird. I can access it on my phone, but on my computer. If any nerds that know about technology are listening to this, please let me know why on my computer I can't access my website, but on my phone I can, even on the same Wi-Fi.
Log off, log back on.
But I'm not even logged in. Like just to look at the website, I can't do it. It's very weird.
That is weird. It sounds like a DNS issue.
Okay, that's what someone else said, and I tried clearing the DNS. I don't know why I'm talking about this on my
It's tech support podcast.
Complain about the stuff that I can't do right because I'm not that good at this. All right, so talk about surviving financially as an indie developer. This is always a big. This is something that when I've surveyed indie developers, having enough money to survive while you're developing a game or having enough time is always the big divide, right? Those are the things.
Well, I think I'm a little older than many of the pack of indies right now. Like I said, I was working for 12 years as a web developer, a few years as a game developer. My wife works. We don't have any kids, so we're not like rich, but we had some savings that we saved up over the past 15 years or so. And she makes decent enough money to keep us alive. And most importantly was supporting me in my, desire to try to do the indie thing. So that's kind of how I was able to do it. But financially right now the game's out for Windows on Steam. But it's not paying the rent, so to speak. I'm hoping with the console release and the addition of season mode, maybe we can get some success. It's kind of more of a console game anyway with the local multiplayer.
I mean, probably after this podcast appearance, your sales will skyrocket.
I'm sure. I see bumps, you know, when I do stuff like this. So, I mean, doing interviews and getting on podcasts and stuff definitely helps get attention out. And people are like, oh, that looks cool, and I'll check it out. Definitely.
Has there been, like, have you gone through a Steam sale yet? Did that have any effect?
I've been shy about doing a sale because I really depended early on a lot of backers to fund the game.
Right.
And to pay for the art and stuff like that. So early on I was doing, I tried to do a Kickstarter, which didn't work out. So then I went through the Humble widget, and you could basically put as much money as you wanted to in the Humble widget, and I could offer digital rewards that way. Uh-huh. Anybody who paid full price at that point, I didn't want to like slap them in the face by putting the game immediately on sale.
Because it came out in December, right? So I guess if you were in the Steam sale in December, that would have been kind of.
Well, I had to basically pick a date based on when everybody else was on sale because, you know, there's a Christmas sale and, you know, I had to get out before that or it would have just gotten completely lost.
Right.
I haven't done that yet. I'm going to wait a little bit before I decide to try putting it on sale.
Okay. Yeah. Or I don't know what the process is like for getting in a Humble Bundle or something like that, but I think, you know, it's sort of, you know, one might argue that it devalues the game, right? And so the full price is no longer even a price that people think of, right? They're just waiting for it to go on sale. And that's how
there's a lot of players that do that. They don't care. They have a whole wish list, and you know, Steam will notify you when stuff on your wish list goes on sale.
So Steam isn't helping either, right?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a marketing guy, so that's probably the most challenging thing for me, but I just kind of approach it as I'm a gamer, so this is what I would like or be annoyed by, and I don't know, try to go from there. Mm-hmm. So I did a bundle to get greenlit initially, but I've avoided any bundles since then, because bundles basically make your game worth about 10 cents a copy.
Right.
And they don't sell that many. So if they sell 1,000, it's like, wow, I just gave a lot of people my game for nothing.
Yeah. Okay. I understand that. So do you think, would it be possible? Like if you went back and didn't want to quit your full-time job and just kept doing that and developed the game on the side, do you think that would have been a viable option? Or
no. That's the main reason I this game had been sitting on the back burner for so long. Okay. Because it's just, I knew it was an 18-month project.
Right.
And we're actually over that now because I'm doing the season mode expansion. But this has been a full-time job. Uh-huh. Not just coding, but doing, promoting it and getting all the legal stuff set up, and everything else you got to do to run a business.
Yeah. Okay. I'm always curious if you think that it would have been possible or not.
Well, my hobbyist games included single screen puzzle games and like an Arkanoid clone. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that was the scope I could deal with when I had a full time job, and it was kind of miserable because that was all my free time. I go to work, I'm in front of a computer, I'm on the train, I'm on my laptop coding my game, I'm at home on the weekends, I'm coding my game. So I'm like always staring at a glowing rectangle, and it was kind of depressing. But so it's hard to do it as a hobby with that amount of scope. But the tools are getting better and better, so I think the types of hobby games are going to get more and more sophisticated as the tools continue to improve.
Okay. So let's talk about the Kickstarter. So you tried to run you did run a Kickstarter, but it was not successful. Why do you think, did you learn any lessons from that? Maybe with things that you did wrong that maybe you would have done differently.
Well, it all goes back to the first PAX South and just how huge that was.
Yeah.
That 2015 was even bigger for me than 2016's show. Cause we had like two or three panels the guys running the panels had come by the booth in the morning, and so they were telling everyone at their panel, oh my god, you got to check out this game. So we were just mobbed. It was like six deep on Saturday, and this is six at a time, so I mean there's like 36 people crammed in front of this booth and trying to play a game nobody's heard of. So it was absolutely crazy. So I thought that was an indication of how popular the game was going to continue to be, so that's why I ran the Kickstarter, thinking, okay, if I can do a few more of these, this will be no problem. I can raise enough money and pay for the art budget.
Right.
But that didn't work out. So I did get some fans. There were, you know, a good number of people who were supporting the game, and we got a few thousand dollars raised, but I didn't get any of that because the Kickstarter didn't get funded.
But they stay fans, right?
That was the important thing. Yeah. So Kickstarter, that became a mailing list, basically. Yep. Everybody who had pledged, I could continue to contact over Kickstarter and say, okay, here's how you can get the game. Here's how you can support the game. Here's how you can get your rewards. Here's how you can get t-shirts. And, you know, just kind of interacted directly with them. They've been awesome from the beginning. And it's been, that's kind of been my core fan base, came from that Kickstarter. So even a failed Kickstarter, you can kind of, again, like, you know, not getting a trademark, all these things, if the bad things can happen to you while you're doing this indie thing, but you can kind of try to make the best of it.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it was good.
That's great to hear. So what are your future plans for Touchdown? And do you have another game in the works or anything like that?
I have a few ideas floating around for the next game, but right now I'm 100% focused on the new season mode add-on, which is going to add a 1-3 player co-op campaign to the game. There's going to be multiple teams that you play against that play against each other. You end up with a ranking at the end of the season, and then you do the playoffs, and each different team is going to have their own AI. So I've got a whole lot of ideas that I'm working on right now for season mode, and I'm streaming development throughout the week on Twitch. So you can check me out on Hest of D's on Twitch channel, and that starts with an A. It's the letter H, Hest.
Okay. Give me a link and I'll put it in show notes.
I sure will. I wish I'd picked my Twitch handle after I set up tipping code.
Yeah, I'll put it on legalmovespodcast.com. Since I can't access my regular website, you can get on I can still get on the podcast website. That's awesome. So we're getting near the end. If you have any advice to someone who's maybe thinking about designing and publishing their first game, what advice would you give to someone?
Well, know your scope is the most important thing. I think anybody will tell you, if you've never done it before, or if you haven't done a game of the scope you're thinking of, you better build in a lot of padding to that, because there's always more problems. There's always things you didn't consider. Things have to get reworked as you take them from paper to the screen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So knowing your limitations is really good. If you're just starting out, I would say do the simplest possible game you could think of, and then cut some features and finish it. Do it start to finish. Make a title screen, high score list, menus, everything, music. Make it a finished game. Even if it's, you know, Pong, just make it a full game, and you'll start to get, okay, here's what it takes to just get that bare minimum.
Right.
And then, you know, you can start getting a little more sophisticated from there. A lot of people get really disappointed. They get some tools and they think, oh, I can make Grand Theft Auto. And it's like,
yeah, absolutely.
No, you really can't.
Yeah. I was the same way. I mean, I was trying, I don't know. I tried and failed to get into some higher level 3D game stuff. Right. Yeah. And I would like have these grand, you know, levels that I was creating, stuff like that, which is just insane. Right. I just don't. One person doesn't have the time. This is stuff that like teams of professionals do, right? So you need to, always keep your scope very limited, especially.
So yeah, look back in time. And this is why you see a lot of retro styled indie games, is because the tools that were cutting edge, top of the line, required a team to use back in the 80s. Now you can do by yourself in, you know, like Unity, for instance. Yep. So yeah, if you take a classic game or make it a little more sophisticated, or do something like Shovel Knight, where it's really an 8-bit style, you know, side scrolling game. You know, you can do that with a few people.
Absolutely. Okay. So where else can we find you besides your Twitch
channel? I'm on Twitter, Tipping Goat. I got a Facebook page for Super Slam Dunk Touchdown. I'm on Reddit in the subreddit SSD Touchdown. And the best place is the Steam forums. So we're looking for feedback for the game right now. We're looking for ideas for season mode, what things people might want to see in season mode. Any feedback, any questions, you know, I'm happy to jump on any of those social media channels and interact with you. So come say hi.
Awesome. In the season mode, is there anything like the only other baseball, or excuse me, sports game I ever played was Baseball Stars on the NES. Is there any kind of like stat tracking or upgrading or anything that's going to be?
There's no upgrades. I think the characters are going to be pretty much still the way they are, but there will be lots of stats. In fact, one of the things I've got in the build now is, depending on where you shoot the ball, when you score, we keep track of where your position was and what type of goal it was. So we can actually put marks on the court. So as you score throughout the season, the idea is you can go to your stats page and see, oh, here's where all my basketball players are scoring from, and here's you know, where all the football players are scoring from and what types of goals. So I'm looking to do lots of statistics throughout the season like that, so you can kind of see how your players are doing and see where you might need to go back into practice mode a little bit.
Very cool. That's awesome. Okay, so for me, you can find me at GameLawyerBlog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development. There are no blog posts up there because, well, not new ones because I can't get to my site, but when I can, I will be doing some blogging. Get on iTunes and give us a 5-star review for the podcast, and check out patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the Patreon campaign and help the show. That's it. Thanks again, Rick, for coming on.
Thank you, Zach.
Awesome.